From GPB News, this is On Second Thought. I'm Adam Ragusea in for Celeste Headlee. On today's show, Americans with different perspectives in their own words. We hear from comedian Maz Jobrani about race and misperceptions of Middle Easterners in America. Cecily McMillan talks about her time at Rikers Island and the history told through the eyes of slaves owned by the founding fathers.
Jefferson, over the course of his entire life, wrote about his hatred for slavery. He called it an abominable crime, a deplorable entanglement. Yet, slavery created the world that Thomas Jefferson knew.
That's coming up this hour. But first, yesterday we focused on music from Macon, including the Allman Brothers and the late great King of Soul, Otis Redding. We wanted to hear some of your favorite songs by Macon musicians. Here are your first thoughts. Rob Turner suggests the live version of Try a Little Tenderness from the 1967 Monterey Pop Festival. Otis was a machine. Ayman Hassam Fidel picks Otis's cover of Sam Cooke's A Change Is Gonna Come. Ayman did not leave a voicemail for us. He said, I don't want to subject listeners to my voice. I'm sure it's lovely. Several of you suggest Blue Sky by the Allman Brothers and mention some lesser-known Macon musicians, including Veronica Randy Crawford and Brad Carter, who's also an actor and artist. We always want to know what you think. Call us at 404-500-9457. That's 404-500-9457. We're on Twitter at OST Talk, or you can post to facebook.com/onsecondthoughtradio, and we might feature your comments on the show. Now, frequent listeners of NPR's Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me may know my next guest. Maz Jobrani is the Iranian-American comedian and actor and a frequent panelist on Wait, Wait. Jobrani says comedians can play an important role in challenging stereotypes. He's been doing this for years. Here he is giving a TED Talk in 2010.
As you can see, when I talk, I speak with an American accent, which you would think as an American, Iranian-American actor, I should be able to play any part, good, bad, what have you. But a lot of times in Hollywood, when casting directors find out you're of Middle Eastern descent, they go, oh, you're Iranian, great. Can you say, I will kill you in the name of Allah? I go, I could say that, but what if I were to say, hello, I'm your doctor? They go, great, and then you hijack the hospital.
Maz Jobrani is coming to Atlanta tomorrow to play at the Punchline Comedy Club, and he joins us now from California via Skype. Good morning.
Hey, Adam. How are you?
I'm very happy to have you. Did you set out to be the Persian comic, or is that just something that happened in response to the world around you, or is that a box that people like us are putting you in?
I think it's kind of, it's a little bit of a box in that I consider myself a comedian that happens to be Iranian. And, you know, I talk about a lot of issues that relate to Iran and the Middle East and the politics of it, but that's not the only thing I talk about. I talk about my kids. I talk about a lot of other stuff. I think what happened was when we first did the Axis of Evil comedy tour, which was a tour we did in, 2007 with other Middle Eastern comedians. Mm-hmm. Some of the jokes that I did at that point, there were four of us on a show. It was a Comedy Central special. And I think a lot of those jokes revolved around the Bush administration, being Middle Eastern in America. I even had a joke where I talked about how Iranians don't like to say we're Iranian. We like to say we're Persian because it sounds nicer and friendlier. And we say we're Persian. You know, I'm Persian like the cat, meow. And, that was a joke. And now to this day, from that long ago, from 9 years ago, when people see me, they go, oh, my God, you know, big fan, Persian like the cat, meow.
Right. Yeah. Let's actually listen to a clip from the Axis of Evil comedy tour. This is actually from the Comedy Central special that you guys did. And again, just to remind everybody, this is all in response to George W. Bush in a State of the Union address, gosh, 9, 10 years ago, referring to Iran, North Korea and... what was the other one in the Axis of Evil?
Iraq.
Yeah, Iraq, Iran. Exactly. This was in the lead up to the war in 2003. Iraq, Iran, and North Korea as an axis of evil. And in response, Maz, my guest here, and a bunch of other comics put together this great show on Comedy Central. Let's listen to a clip.
I tell them my American friends, I go, yeah, I'm Iranian. They go, oh, so you're Arab. And I'm like, no, we're actually different. We're not Arab. But, you know, I mean, we're similar. You know, we're all getting shot at. You know, that's one thing. But Iranians are actually ethnically, we're actually, you know, we're Aryan, we're white, so stop shooting. You know, that's what I'm trying to. And then my American friends go, well, how can we tell you apart? How can we? And I go, well, it's in the accent. It's in the accent. Iranians, when Iranians speak, they talk a lot slower. Iranians talk like this. Iranians talk like this. We talk very slow, like, you know, maybe we just shot some heroin. We're falling asleep.
Okay, so it's been a long time, a lot of years since then, Maz Jobrani. Is life better in the United States now? Do you find casting directors being less eager to typecast you in those kinds of roles?
I don't know if life – I think actually it might have gotten a little worse. The casting part of it has gotten better. I think a lot of networks are trying now to have more diversity in their shows. I think there's definitely been people trying to create parts – for Middle Eastern and Muslim and Arab and Iranian actors that are more nuanced. But we still have a lot of terrorist parts. There's still a lot of that. I for myself personally, have just said I don't want to go on those auditions anymore.
Yeah.
So for me, it's been fine. I still do play a lot of characters that have accents, which I don't mind as much.
Sure.
But I think overall, if you look at it, this world that we live in, we know that Islamophobia has gone up. I don't think that the Trump campaign has helped at all. And I think, as you see around the world, people are just more and more scared of Middle Easterners and Muslims. I personally, because of the way I sound, the way I look, I think sometimes people might think they don't even know if am I Mexican, am I Brazilian, what am I? They don't necessarily know. But I'm always reading the news to see what's been going on. And there's constantly, as I'm sure you're aware, there's been a lot of just Arabs and Middle Easterners getting kicked off of airplanes just for speaking their language. So I don't think that America is any better than it was in 2007.
My guest is Maz Jobrani, comedian. You know him from Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, among other places. He is playing the Punchline Comedy Club in Atlanta this week. You mentioned the Trump campaign. You've been talking about that in your stand-up routines. Here's a clip of you commenting on Trump's appeal his appeal in the sense that people feel that he says what's on his mind, and hear how that has swayed your Iranian-American mother. Let's listen.
I went to visit her. She goes, Maz, I like this guy because he said what's on his mind. I go, Mom, are you crazy? He's anti-immigrant, okay? I go, if he became president, your relatives couldn't come to visit you. She goes, I don't like them anyway.
Okay, so that's a really funny bit. Did you ever worry that it could be taken the wrong way, that it could be taken to be making light of or actually kind of making to seem benign Trump's proposed policy of blocking the United States to any and all Muslims?
You know, I think that the unfortunate thing about comedy or anything that you put out there now, it's going to get interpreted however people want to interpret it. So I can't manage how people interpret it. I just know that what happened was the real thing that happened was that I went to my mother's house. I was actually trying to avoid Trump material because there was so much of it. And I thought, how am I going to do anything that's different? And I went to my mother's house and she actually goes, yeah, I like this guy. He's kind of entertaining. And then I go, what? Are you going to vote for him? She's like, no, I wouldn't vote for him. I just say he says a lot of entertaining stuff. So I had to take that and turn it into this bit of my mother saying that she basically supports the guy because she doesn't want her relatives coming to visit her. But then what happened was after that, and I've added to the bit, I was in an Uber with an older Armenian guy who actually did like Trump, and he was defending Trump. And the irony to me was that this guy's an immigrant and he loves Trump. So then that turned into a bit about how there's a lot of immigrants like Trump. And there's truth to that. You know, what's interesting to me with Trump and his Islamophobia and all that is that a lot of Muslims actually probably have more conservative views. If you're really a religious Muslim, if you're going to have views that might be more in line with Trump than you would think. You may think that, you know, marriage should be between a man and a woman, not gay marriage. You may think that women do not deserve equal pay, I should say. So there's a lot of things that the Trump people probably have in common with these people that they pretend to hate. But they wouldn't know it because they're too scared to even let them into the country. So when you see that there's nuances, that there's grays, I feel that you got to talk about it, and I'm not worried about how people are going to interpret it.
Maz, with our last couple of minutes here, you're talking to public radio listeners. What can you tell us about what it's like to do Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me? Is that show as fun to tape as it is to listen to, or is there a lot of rigmarole when you're on stage?
I love taping it, man. What I tell everybody is, if it ever comes to, because it travels from time to time, so if it ever comes to Atlanta, go see the live taping of Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, because we do closer to 2 hours of taping, and then the show itself is, once it's edited, I think is about maybe 52 minutes. So you miss a lot, and it is a lot of fun. I mean, sometimes you sit there and a few minutes go by and you haven't said anything funny or witty or anything at all, and you start getting intimidated, you start sweating, you're like, I got to come up with some stuff. There's 2,000 people looking at me. But it's a blast, man. I really, that's one of my favorite things to do. And it's a great show to be on.
So the raw taping is obviously a lot longer than what we hear on the radio, as you mentioned. Does that mean that there are times when the director is asking you to do a joke over again? I mean, that seems like a nightmare to try to do in front of a live audience.
No, the live audience, actually, if people that have seen it will know what happens. We run it all the way through. So it's not that anyone's telling you to do anything over again. It's just that we are just babbling on. We're basically trying out stuff. We're throwing out jokes and hoping that it hits, you know, because none of the stuff is it's all improvised. The only thing that we work on before the show, the panelists at least, is the Bluff the Listener. Right. They give us that topic the night before, and we create our own Bluff the Listener, unless if you have the real story. And then the other thing that they tell us is what's going to be the prediction at the very, very, very end. But the rest of the show, you're improvising. So whatever that news item of the day is, you just got to go for it. And so what they will edit down to maybe a 30-second little blurb will end up being us maybe riffing on that for 5 minutes. The part that is actually boring for the audience at the end is when we do go through it, if we've bumbled it at all, then we go back and we do pickups, and the audience has to sit there and listen to that. And that's kind of boring, but we got to do it.
Okay. And it's live radio right here, so no pickups. And luckily we didn't need any. That's comedian Maz Jobrani. He's performing Thursday through Saturday at the Punchline Comedy Club in Atlanta. Hope you have a good run there. Thank you for being on the show, Maz.
Thanks for having me. Have a great day.
You too. Atlanta activist Cecily McMillan is only 27 years old, but she's experienced things that most will never face. 2 years ago, she was arrested and convicted for assaulting a police officer during an Occupy Wall Street protest. She was sentenced to serve 3 months on Rikers Island in New York. Rikers is one of the largest correctional facilities in the world. It also has faced a number of accusations for abuse and prisoner neglect. And McMillan writes about her time in Rikers in a new memoir titled The Emancipation of Cecily McMillan, An American Memoir. Celeste Headley sat down with McMillan earlier this month to talk about her time spent in prison. And a word of warning here, this conversation contains some very disturbing details. Celeste started the interview by asking McMillan to recount the events that led to her arrest in 2014.
Just so we can get it out of the way immediately, because it's not doesn't seem to be the focus of your memoir, let's talk about your actual arrest.
Sure.
Because you were eventually convicted of felony second-degree assault, although I've seen you describe it as you and the police officer assaulting each other. Why did you get arrested?
I guess, actually, what happened between us wasn't even a matter of assault or even self-defense. Actually, I have no memory of the incident in question. I try to explain it to people as kind of like a car crash. So if you remember in the civil rights movement, where people worked on things like nonviolent realistic trainings, you know, they threw eggs at each other and screamed at each other, so they would make sure that they would turn off those like very natural self-defense respondents, you know, the natural things that you do. Well, I actually ran a lot of those trainings in New York City, where we beat each other with Swiffer poles and pepper sprayed each other to make sure that no matter what, we would never respond in a sort of like instinctual defensive manner. So when the officer grabbed me from behind. I did not know that it was even an officer. I was told to clear the park. It was St. Patrick's Day, and I was wearing all green. I mean, head to toe, like green polka-dotted tights, eyeliner, green nail polish. I mean, the last thing I said to my father was, "Don't worry, Daddy, I will not get arrested in this outfit." And so when they said clear the park, I was like, "Yep, it's my cue. I'm going to go right now." And I was about four steps away from the exit when I felt what seemed to be a very large person grab me at my left hip. When I felt that person grab me, I put my hand on top of that hand. Like, what is this? Is somebody grabbing me? I didn't know. You know, maybe it was a friend who was trying to grab me to run with me out of the park. I had no idea. And so this hand moved from my left hip across my torso and then across my right breast. And that's actually the last thing I remember, is somebody lifting me backwards by my right breast, like a ripping feeling. And if you can imagine my hand being on top of his hand, his motion of his arm moving my arm with his, if you see where my elbow is going right here, it's gonna pop you in the face.
Yeah, she's we're in radio, so she's lifting her elbow up into the sky above near her right ear.
Yeah, put your hand like a palm backwards by your ear and see where your elbow goes. So I think about it like with little kids who grab hands and go, "Stop hitting yourself."
Yeah.
So it was like his motion. It's called a seatbelt grab, and it's actually a tactic that has been rendered illegal by the police. It was discontinued in 2001 because, as you can see, it would require you to necessarily sexually assault a woman. It was a mechanism that the police had used previously in order to stop an assailant who was in the middle of motion to upset their balance, to throw them off. That night, another woman, Cressa, was assaulted in the same way by a different police officer, and she has since earned a $95,000 settlement in which she referenced my case. Cressa and I were the only ones that night, but there is a group of 23 women who are, besides us, launching a civil suit against the New York City Police Department for the same maneuver.
So you ended up getting a sentence of 3 months. Now, that sentence of felony second-degree assault could carry a sentence of 7 years.
Yeah, it's actually a mandatory minimum sentence of 2 years. And the DA had announced to the public that they were going to give me that time. If I were a black woman, a brown woman, for instance, then I would absolutely still be in jail. If I were a black man, I do believe I'd be dead.
Although most of the jurors on your case said that they thought you shouldn't be sentenced to any time at all.
After they were released, after they found me guilty and I was remanded to Rikers without bail, just to give you an understanding of that, the Charleston shooter received a $1 million bail for his weapons charge. I was remanded without bail, no matter how much money. It was put down, $1 billion. When I got to Rikers, people asked me, "How many officers did you kill?"
So to go back to the jurors, they actually wrote a note asking the judge not to sentence you to any time. Why?
They were released, and once they were able to see all of the details that the DA specifically kept out, and also to see how egregiously the DA lied about my history, then they all came together and wrote a letter to the judge saying—
9 out of 12 of them.
Sorry, yes. 9 out of 12 of them came together and wrote a letter to the judge saying, "Let her out of Rikers, please. This is not a place for somebody like this." And that had a big impact on the judge's decision, as well as the mass media support geared by rock groups that came together and public figures and city council persons. I mean, it's the same show of support we would hope that every individual in this country has.
Now, I mean, most people, especially people who have spent any time in New York, have probably heard horror stories about Rikers. I mean, it's even been in movies, Rikers.
Oh, yeah. I mean, the HBO series The Night Of has just come out. And to be quite frank, that is a very nice way to depict Rikers.
You're saying that HBO series depicts Rikers not as bad as it is.
Yeah, no. There is no series that I have seen on any jail whatsoever that even compares to the horror of what Rikers is.
Okay, so Lynn, let's examine exactly why you say that. You were there for 58 days. I almost said only 58 days, but 58 days can be a long time if it's in a horrible place. But what exactly was it that made Rikers, to your mind, a place of, I guess, mental and sometimes physical torture?
I think that the thing that is most debilitating about Rikers is that there is no rule of law. They give you a rule book. A lot of it is outdated. And beyond that, the rule of law changes by which guard you have, and more to the point, which captain is on duty. I watched a woman die in front of me.
This is Judith?
Judith, yes. And for instance, again, in that situation, the female guards were helpful to our scenario. They let us drag her down when the medical professionals said, don't bring her down. It's not a medical emergency. This woman was vomiting up pieces of her innards. Like, she, by the time she got down to the hospital, she was covered in blood, chunks of her insides, and the medical professionals looked at her and said, you call this an emergency? Judith had succumbed to a coma by the time she was in the hospital and died from organ failure. Her sister would have never even known what had happened to her unless she had written, finally, Rikers to see if she was in there. She got a letter back that said, inmate no longer here. Not inmate went to the hospital and died. Inmate no longer here. She called around all the hospitals. She found out that her sister Judith was in the hospital and was seconds away from death and had no idea what had happened and would have never been notified. It wasn't until the New York Times picked up my article about the horrors of Rikers that her sister was piecing, her sister who's a correctional officer nonetheless, who was piecing through the New York Times and said, could this be my Judith? Called the New York Times, and New York Times called me, and I was the only reason, and the New York Times was the only reason that this poor lady ever knew what happened to her sister. Now imagine how many people die there every day and don't have the privilege of writing a New York Times article about it. They just disappear.
So, I mean, this explains, there's two things that you've said need to be fixed immediately, not just in Rikers, but throughout the prison system. The first one was comprehensive medical exams.
Exactly.
When inmates come to the prison, and access to medical professionals within very timely time frames.
Which is exactly what the women of Rikers specifically asked for. Yeah, their demand.
The second one, and it sounds like the second one partially comes from your own experience with trying to file a grievance, because when something occurred between you and a guard, your lawyer told you not to file a grievance.
Oh,
why?
No. Yeah, I mean, this guard slammed me straight, I mean, into a wall. It's on camera. And I called him. I have white privilege. I called him.
You called your lawyer?
And I said, but it's on camera. How can he get away with this? You know, I'm totally indignant. My lawyer said, Cecily, you're in Rikers. What do you think happens if you file a grievance and a guard that has it out for you? Whatever they want to happen to you, they can turn a blind eye. They know people in there. You know that. They can walk away and leave you somewhere where there are no cameras. You can get raped. You can die mysteriously. You can totally be traumatized. You cannot be fed. This is what happens to you if you fail to bend over and take it in jail.
So that's the second thing that you think you say needs to be fixed immediately, is that people should be safe when filing grievances. But how do you accomplish that?
Well, you just said it. You said people should be safe from filing grievances. We accomplish that by thinking of prisoners as what they are, people. The biggest thing we've got to work on in this country is that no matter who you are a citizen of this country. You are a human being in, we say, the most powerful, freest country in the world, right? You have rights, no matter who you are. And that is exactly the problem right now. It's as soon as the police pick somebody up, they're no longer considered people, and things can just happen to them because you have an entire public out here who goes, well, they must have done something to deserve what? To be raped? To have doctors put their hands in them? Think about the logic of that. I mean, exactly the way that you just thought of these people. That will change everything. This is a democracy.
How does that look, though, in practical terms? If you go to a prison and say, okay, you need to start thinking of your inmates as people.
No, it's just people like you and I who have privilege, who have power, who can talk out about things. Right now, who goes to prisons? Depending on even if they work in there, who chooses to have a job in prison every day? The working class and the lower sector of the working class. Who goes to prison? The underclass, people who never even had access to jobs, school to prison pipeline. Who goes to visit those people? Their family members who often don't have access to jobs or healthcare. Essentially, the people who are associated with prisons right now are people who have no political power whatever. I can't even vote. I can't run for office. I can't be on a jury. But you can be on a jury. Our listeners, a lot of them can probably be on a jury. A lot of them can write letters to, the representatives, city council, state. A lot of them can call in and say, listen, you can't treat people like this. You know, maybe they committed a crime. Maybe they didn't. I don't know. But they're paying their time. They're doing their time. I mean, it's the conditions are getting to a level in which 1 in 12 people in Georgia are under the custody of the state. 1 in 12. You know how many white female prisoners were in Rikers? 5. And all of us were half Latina. When we're talking about a group of people that are just black and brown people in Rikers, when we're talking about a situation where there is no oversight, where you are being raped, where you are being killed, where you are disappearing, I met women that were born in there, several women that were born in there and returned throughout their entire intergenerational lives. Do you know how hard it is to me? I have a master's degree from the New School. I once was the child care provider for Jimmy Carter's great-grandson. Like, in my lawyer's closing speech, they said, send her home, send her back to grad school, let her go on to become a city council person, a state senator, who knows, the first female president of the United States. That's how people thought of me. That is who I was. I can't get a cleaning job now. I can't work at the gas station up the street. And that's me. At this color, I'm pointing to a very pale white arm right now. Imagine what happens for people who don't have you to talk to. Lives just disappear in the wind.
I mean, obviously, people can't see your face, but they can probably hear in your voice. This is a very emotional topic for you. Is this now? I mean, you have been an activist, it looks like, from your bio, for a very, very long time. Is this now your project? Is prison reform?
Absolutely. And I would say it's because I was in there with a group of women who not only didn't have any freedom, never had any freedom, like never had any opportunity to break out of their situations. Never. I mean, Gigi and Princess, my 2 16-year-olds, had been forced into child prostitution from the age of 12, like quite literally, like never had the opportunity to participate in this world that you and I live in. And yet they had more humanity than anybody I had ever met. Their constant want. I mean, they made these welcome baskets for everybody when they came in. They created these communities. I was in the sentence dorm for 6 weeks. There was not a single fight. We're talking women sleeping, you know, half a foot away from each other in beds all day, every day. And there wasn't a single fight. It's like when you look at people like that, you realize the power, like the possibilities of humanity. When you can come together and you can thrive together, you can learn to live together and listen to each other intergenerationally, you know, interculturally, Dominicans and Puerto Ricans and, Caribbean Black folks from Antigua or from Jamaica and Black folks that had always been in America. And, you know, I mean, it's these women that just got to be women together, respect each other, love each other. And I have never experienced anything like that on the outside. That is incredible. And I think that we could learn a lot from people who have been at the very bottom. I mean, we say that a society is only as good as its bottommost people. I think we ought to look for them for guidance, and I think we ought to give them support.
That was a portion of Celeste Headlee's interview with the Atlanta activist Cecily McMillan. Her book is called The Emancipation of Cecily McMillan, an American Memoir. It came out last month. Last year, over 2,800 claims were filed against the New York Department of Corrections. These include allegations of sexual abuse, inhumane prisoner treatment, and wrongful death. We reached out to the New York Department of Corrections for comment on the allegations mentioned in this interview. This is their statement, quote, "Conditions at Rikers are much changed since 2014. Commissioner Joseph Ponce's 14-point anti-violence reform agenda launched in early 2015 is creating a culture of safety for staff and inmates alike." End quote. But the violence does continue. Just this past Friday, 2 guards were assaulted and 1 inmate's neck was slashed. For more information on current prison statistics, visit gpbnews.org. This summer, First Lady Michelle Obama highlighted a piece of American history that is not terribly well known.
I wake up every morning in a house that was built by slaves. And I watch my daughters two beautiful, intelligent black young women playing with their dogs on the White House lawn.
The White House, literally built by slaves. For generations, U.S. presidents had slaves. 10 of the first 15 presidents were either slave owners or they were raised in slave-holding households. This is a fact that's often left out of history books. You may know author Ken Davis from his Don't Know Much About History series. Davis chronicles the lesser-known history of the presidency and slavery in his book, In the Shadow of Liberty, The Hidden History of Slavery, Four Presidents and Five Black Lives. Ken joins us now from New York. Good morning, Ken Davis.
Good morning, Adam. It's a pleasure to be with you. I just want to start, before I say anything,
sure.
I was listening to Celeste's riveting interview with Cecily McMillan.
Yeah.
And part of the reason we talk about history, I think, is to connect the past to the present. And listening to her speak about Rikers and the justice system in America today, part certainly of the legacy of slavery is what we are talking about when we're talking about the criminal justice system today and separate and unequal law in this country. So always important to remember that the past isn't really past, as William Faulkner once said.
Well, I think we'll be sure to circle back to that. But for right now, let's start at the beginning of the story that you're telling in this new book. You focus on the narratives not of the slave-owning presidents, the very famous people, but on the narratives of the slaves themselves, the people owned by those presidents. That's obviously a very intentional choice on your part.
Completely. The fact is that for about 30 years, I've been writing about American history and was always fascinated by this question of the contradiction between men like Washington and Jefferson talking about liberty and equality, but then going back to plantations completely dependent upon enslaved labor. And I tried to answer that question in their words and actions for a long time and decided at this point, no, I have to really look at it from the other side. So I focused on the stories of five enslaved people, each of them owned in the technical sense by a president. Two of them belonged, again, legally belonged to George Washington, and the others were the property of Jefferson, Madison, and Andrew Jackson. Of course, we say this that slaves built the White House. Of course, Washington and his enslaved people preceded the White House. He brought enslaved people with him to New York City and then to Philadelphia, and that's an intriguing story.
Could you give us the short version of a story of any one of these particular enslaved people who you're talking about?
Well, there are such riveting stories. Let me start with the beginning. The first is about a young man named William Lee, or Billy Lee. And in his day, in the certainly the late 18th century and into the early part of the 19th century, he was perhaps the most famous African-American man in America. People knew him as Washington's loyal manservant. Billy Lee had been purchased as a part of an estate sale, essentially. Washington went to a neighbor's property. His entire estate was being sold off to pay debts. And Washington purchases with basically a letter of credit for boys, and two of them are named William Lee and Frank Lee. We don't know who their fathers were. Lee was the name of their owner. Perhaps he was their father. They were what were known as mulattoes, or light-skinned blacks, and so Washington brought those two back to be used as house servants. The other two boys were dark-skinned, and they were destined for the fields, because in that time in Virginia, a light-skinned servant was more prized. And it's, you know, this is all repulsive, deplorable, yeah, we might say today, to talk about and think about. But a light-skinned servant was prized as a house servant because literally they looked more white. They appeared more white. And visitors to the white to Mount Vernon later commented upon how many of the enslaved servants actually really looked white. They were given dressed in livery and made to appear like the servants of an aristocratic English gentleman at the time. Billy Lee was with Washington every day of his life for the rest of his life, and he was with him when they went out to hunt in the morning, when he surveyed the plantations. Billy Lee was with George Washington when he goes off to Boston, to Cambridge, to take over the army. Billy Lee is with George Washington when he has the great victory at Yorktown, securing America's freedom. Billy Lee is with Washington during Valley Forge and the crossing of the Delaware. Billy Lee is with Washington in Philadelphia when the Constitution is being written, and Washington presides over that. So he truly was a witness to American history that we almost only see through Washington's eyes. Billy Lee left no writings, no personal documentation, but there's a good deal about him in other documents because he was so closely connected to Washington. William Lee is also significant because he is the only person who is immediately emancipated upon Washington's death in his last will and testament.
Speaking with author Ken Davis, Ken has a new book out that explores the lives of some of the slaves who were enslaved by four early U.S. presidents. That's the story of Billy Lee. I imagine part of the reason that you're able to draw Billy so vividly in your book is because his life is well documented, because he spent so much time with Washington. How were you able to draw and illustrate the lives of those enslaved people who were out in the fields and whose lives were no doubt not as well documented?
Well, indeed, all of the five that I discuss in this book are really people who are very closely related. I don't mean by familial ties.
Sure.
That happened also. We can come back to that question. But they were in the president's households 24/7, as we like to say today. There's much less documentation, obviously, about the typical field hand. We know what they ate. We know how many blankets they were given each year and what their clothing was like, because Washington would give his enslaved farmhands a set of clothes each year and a blanket each year. Jefferson did the same thing at Monticello. So we know many of the details of that. But these five people we do have documentation about. In some cases, two in particular, we actually have their firsthand accounts of what life was like. Isaac Granger Jefferson, to be more precise, later told his story late in his life, after he had been emancipated, to a man who wrote the story down. And that record actually is one of the major sources for a great many historians to draw on Jefferson's life and his relationship in particular with enslaved people. Another gentleman I write about is a man named Paul Jennings, and he actually wrote what is considered the first memoir by any worker in the White House. He happened to be an enslaved worker. He was taken to Washington, D.C., and the White House when he was 10 years old by James and Dolly Madison. He had been born at Montpelier, Madison's home, and he spent the next 8 years with the Madisons in Washington, D.C., and it's Paul Jennings who is in the White House and sets the table on the day the British attack Washington, D.C., and burn the White House to the ground. And his account is one of the real eyewitness accounts of the burning of the White House in August of 1814. A very, very famous scene. But he describes actually setting the table and putting out the ale and the cider for the president and his cabinet for when they come back. But it's actually the British who sit down to that meal when they reach the White House. And so his account is actually also a major source for historians who have gone back to look at the day-to-day life of what being an enslaved person in Madison's life was like. Paul Jennings is actually in Madison's bedroom at the moment of his death, because he also served Madison for the rest of his life, eventually slowly gained his freedom. And it was during that period of emancipation that he was able to record what are known as the Reminiscences of a Colored Man in James Madison's White House.
We're speaking with author Ken Davis. His new book is In the Shadow of Liberty, The Hidden History of Slavery, Four Presidents, and Five Black Lives. We're talking there about Paul Jennings, a man enslaved by President James Madison, worked at the White House. In 1865, Jennings published, as you mentioned, the only known account by a White House slave. His great-great-grandson, Hugh Allen, talked with NPR in 2009. The great-great-grandson says that based on Jennings' memoir, the relationship between slaves and masters was a lot more complicated than history tries to make it. Let's listen.
I think when you read it, you see that there is some respect and I think some love that he feels for his master. But I also am sure that being exposed to the thoughts of Mr. Madison, especially with his role in developing the Constitution, a lot of those ideas rubbed off and I think caused Paul to be the sort of person that he became.
Now, after he was freed, Jennings visited former First Lady Dolly Madison, who was impoverished at the time. He occasionally gave her small sums of money. Speaking with CBS News, Allen says that White House slaves should be remembered for more than just being held captive.
It also creates a place in history for how slaves were a part of the history of the United States, not an index, you know, or a footnote that's at the back of the book.
Ken Davis, I imagine that you take Hugh Allen's point there, but is there a danger in emphasizing or talking about what could be glibly referred to as the positive aspects of an enslaved person's experience in the White House?
Well, I think that you have to take Jennings or Isaac Granger's references to Jefferson with a very large grain of salt. Granger writes in the 1840s or tells his story in the 1840s. Jennings in 1865, of course, after the Civil War. But one must still remember they were talking about the most admired, beloved right. heroes in American history. And probably we have to kind of footnote or bracket everything they say with the notion that it would have been foolish, if not dangerous, to speak ill of these people. And it also does get to this very complex relationship that these presidents, if you ask them about these people, would describe them, in many cases they did, as part of my family. And I don't mean to say that in the sense of, you know, gone with the wind, one big happy paternalistic situation, but they did refer to them as my people, my family in some cases, in the sense of an extended family. And it does get at this very, very complicated, tricky interpersonal relationship between slave and master, and certainly between enslaved person of some privilege to live in or near the big house was certainly sure. a lot better off than living off in one of the field hovels, and that's the only way to describe them. And so it's, you know, we always have to take this with a little, you know, these firsthand accounts with a little bit of caution, but they still understood, and certainly Jennings understood, what Madison was talking about. He stood there at Montpelier while the great men of the time, including Thomas Jefferson, who would often come and visit Madison at Montpelier, the Marquis de Lafayette, who was an outspoken opponent of slavery, other men were in Montpelier debating the future of slavery. Paul Jennings has to be standing there, perhaps serving dinner, listening to this and wondering about his place in it. And indeed, he fights very hard late in his life to win his own emancipation, which he ultimately does.
We spoke to Emory University professor Thee Smith about your work. Thee is with the social justice group Southern Truth and Reconciliation. He says that while more stories about slave narratives are really welcome, he's not terribly optimistic that they're going to have the intended effect of erasing stereotypes. Let's listen.
For many of us, this is a kind of unending effort that always falls short of its potential impact of educating the public sufficiently to end common stereotypes. And I do try to be optimistic. I believe the Dalai Lama, when he says something like, if we could teach every 8-year-old how to meditate, we would have world peace in one generation. But I do think it requires constant effort, and I applaud Ken Davis for this effort.
Ken Davis, in the last 60 seconds that we have here, I'd like to get your response to that. I mean, your book is targeted at a younger audience for precisely this reason, right?
It is. I think that we have to, you know, really make sure that we clear the schools and the textbooks of the worst misconceptions and myths we live with. But I think we're at a real extraordinary moment with the museum opening up, as you know, on the Mall, a museum of African American history, Mrs. Obama's speech, Colin Kaepernick's protests about a racist national anthem, Black Lives Matter. Discussion of race is overwhelming in this presidential campaign. I think we are coming to a different kind of reckoning. Certainly the removal of the Confederate symbols from whether it's the flag coming down or stained glass coming out or Georgetown's attempts to reconcile with the descendants of enslaved people who are sold off to keep the college afloat. We are at a moment, I think, of very, very real reckoning, if not reconciliation.
That's author Ken Davis. His new book chronicles some of the slaves who served four early presidents. It's called In the Shadow of Liberty, The Hidden History of Slavery, Four Presidents and Five Black Lives. Ken, really appreciate it. Thanks for talking with us.
Thank you so much.